Hey there, welcome to LiveWire. I'm your host, Luke Burbank. This week on the show, we are talking about joy, which we can all use more of in our lives, always. We're here to talk about writer and poet Ross Gay and his book, Inciting Joy, which he's going to read from. Then we're going to bond over stories of childhood skateboarding, which is going to be joyful. Then we're going to catch up with Michelin star chef and writer Elena Regan on why she loves cooking but doesn't love being a chef. She's going to explain the distinction. And then she's going to talk about her new book, Fieldwork, A Forager's Guide. Plus, we're finally going to get to the bottom of the rumor of if Elena once sold homemade ranch dressing at a Chicago farmer's market. She says she didn't. I'm not so sure. All that plus music from Baroque Betty and Mood Area 52. Our mood? Joyful. That you're sticking around for LiveWire, which gets started right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. This episode of LiveWire was originally recorded in March of 2023. We hope you enjoy it. Let's get to the show. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. Are you ready to play a little station location identification examination?
I sure am.
This is where I quiz Elena about a place in the country where LiveWire is on the radio. She's got to try to guess where I'm talking about. This, I'm just going to manage everyone's expectations. Let's just say it is a wonderful but slightly boutique location in America, okay?
Okay.
So don't put too much pressure on yourself, all right?
Okay.
This city gets its name from the Choctaw language. It's derived from the word meaning red rock. And speaking of rock, rock legend Little Richard lived here at the time of his passing. This is where Little Richard was living.
I know he's from Georgia originally, but
this is not, I'll give you a hint, it's not in the state of Georgia, which leaves you 49 other possibilities. This city's Cascade Hollow Distillery is located along America's Whiskey Trail, and George Dickel whiskey is produced in this place.
Oh, I do believe you're talking about Tullahoma, Tennessee.
Oh my gosh.
You have me at George Dickel, man.
The whiskey. I don't think I'd ever seen the name Tullahoma, Tennessee. That's where we're on WTML radio. My goodness, that is really impressive. All right. Shout out to everyone tuning in Tullahoma, Tennessee on WTML. All right. Should we get to the show?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. Take it away.
From PRX, it's LiveWire! This week, poet and essayist Ross Gay.
The sort of notion of privilege, like, oh, you're privileged because you have a place to garden, or you're privileged because you have breathable air, is evidence actually of disprivilege. You know, it's evidence of a brutality.
And chef and writer Elena Regan.
Chefs are storming through kitchens and they're mad at their employees and they're, you know, like, this thing needs to be this way. It's like, what's the point?
With music from Baroque Betty, with Mood Area 52, and our fabulous house band. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank.
Hey, thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thanks to everyone tuning in all across the country. We have an absolutely wonderful show in store for you this week. We asked the LiveWire listeners a question. We asked, describe your perfect weekend. One of the people that we're interviewing this week, Elena Regan, runs this place in the woods of Michigan called the Milkweed Inn. And it is like the most perfect woodsy weekend you could ever imagine. So we're going to hear the listener response to that question, what their perfect weekend might be. Coming up first, though, it's time for the best news we heard all week. This is our little reminder at the top of the show that there is good news happening out there in the world. Elena, what's the best news you heard all week?
Well, speaking of Tennessee and other great places across this country that have Waffle Houses, I have some Waffle House best news. This is a Waffle House in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the Hunter family shows up for breakfast at least once every weekend. And they always request to sit in the section of a server there named Devontae Gardner. Devontae knows everybody's order, including 8-year-old Kazen. Kazen gets a high five every time he comes in. And then Devontae knows that he wants hash browns with cheese, which in Waffle House parlance is covered. Anyway, one day, Kazen was in that Waffle House with his grandfather, and he heard Mr. Gardner asking around on leads on a very cheap car, because it turns out he lives far away now from the Waffle House and has to walk several miles.
This was Mr. Gardner, their typical server there at the Waffle
House.
Yeah,
Devontae Gardner. Yeah. The apartment where he lived with his family, with his wife and two daughters, was uninhabitable because of a black mold problem. They had to move to a motel, and he was walking several miles from that motel to the Waffle House to go to work and make everybody smile like he normally does. So 8-year-old Kazen goes home and tells his mom. His mom and her husband actually had a black mold issue that made them have to leave a place where they used to live. So she totally empathized. And so she told Kazen it would be okay if they started a GoFundMe. So Kazen starts the GoFundMe, asking for $5,000 to get Mr. Devontae Gardner a new car, but then a local news station picks it up, and now $50,000 has been raised for this amazing Waffle House server.
Wow, so I guess he's got a Tesla now.
Yeah, well, I think he's going to get a car plus a year's rent. It's going to take a little pressure off.
And that's awesome.
The gratitude in this story is just so amazing. It's the thing that makes me feel the best. Devontae Gardner says, I am thankful that I have a job that I enjoy, but it's really hard to save enough to improve my family's stations. But we are slowly working our way back. I love working at Waffle House because I have the opportunity to make people feel good every day. And when Kazen was asked about his act of generosity, he said, sometimes people just need a little help, which is very cute and totally
good
true.
Good lesson to learn as a young kid. Absolutely. Speaking of food, the best news I saw this week involves pizza, where the sport of pizza acrobatics, also known sometimes as pizza freestyle, or for those not very much in the know, pizza tossing, is finally getting its due. A great profile in the Washington Post of a guy named Tony Geminani, who has been competing in pizza acrobatics for like almost 35 years now. He started off when he was 17. He was working at his brother's pizzeria in Castro Valley, California. And he just noticed that he could kind of like do cool stuff with the pizza dough. Like he could throw it like a little higher. You know how like the sort of movie version of somebody making pizzas.
Like cocktail, but for pizza.
Right? Exactly. Well, he was just like really good at it. And he was throwing it higher and higher. And so then he started just kind of like seeing what the limits of what he could actually do was. And he got really good at it. Part of how he got good was he would sew these kind of like circular things that were like a pizza dough and then practice with them all day long when he wasn't at the pizzeria. And he got super good at it to the point where he's won like something like, well, he's won a total of 13 world championships in various parts of the pizza competitive space, Elena.
Okay.
So he's got 7 of them are for pizza acrobatics. He's also won several Guinness World Records, including largest pizza base spun in 2 minutes. By the way, that was 33.2 inches if you're scoring at home. Now, the reason that I found this so fascinating is because, do you know, I've actually watched the like world championships of this happening in Las Vegas. I attended something called the International Pizza Expo and Conference once in Las Vegas. And I saw him there doing this. It is incredible. They're like on a stage. There's like pyrotechnics. There's loud music. They're spinning the pies. It's like actually very physical and takes a lot of practice and physicality. Anyway, Tony is now kind of transitioning into being sort of the elder statesperson of the pizza acrobatics world. But what's cool is he's now, because he's like on YouTube and all these videos are out, he's getting young people into it, including women and other people who maybe, you know, wouldn't have traditionally been included in the pizzeria, pizza acrobatics world. So I can just say, having seen Tony in person, the guy is amazing, and I'm glad he's finally getting his due. Pizza acrobatics, being treated as the sport that it is, Elena.
Sport of the future.
That's right.
Right up there with pickleball.
The most delicious sport that I know about. That's the best news that I heard all week. All right, let's get our first guest on over to the show. He's a New York Times bestselling author of The Book of Delights. He's also got four books of poetry out. The Boston Globe calls his latest book, Inciting Joy, a raucous affair with dancing, fabulous covers of all your favorite songs, tons of food, a backyard full of folks, and all their sorrows, too. Book Riot calls it essential reading. This is our friend Ross Gay, recorded at Town Hall in Seattle. Take a listen. Ross, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's really nice to see you. The last time I think that we talked to you, we were talking about your previous book, The Book of Delights, where you really kind of did a practice of finding something to be delighted about every single day and writing about it.
Yeah.
And now you've got this book, Inciting Joy. Did your previous book kind of feed naturally into this latest book?
You know, probably because it did, as did the book before it, Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, partly because people would be, you know, I'd have conversations with people about joy on account of those two books, which I was thinking about somewhat, but I wasn't thinking about it as a sort of long and maybe like lifelong sort of inquiry, you know. But after having enough conversations, it for sure felt like, oh, I could talk about this and think about this for a long time.
Did you have something that you wanted to do with this book, which is about joy, that didn't maybe happen with the previous book, which was about delight, or the one before it, which was about gratitude?
I think one thing I wanted to like spin out, I wanted to write longer pieces. Uh-huh. You know, that was one thing for sure. I also felt like there's a couple impulses for writing the book. I mean, many. But one of them is that in some of those conversations, people would say things like, but how can you write about joy at a time like this? Mm. And my sort of immediate response, sort of in my head anyway, is like, that's a f-ing stupid question. But I get it. I get it.
The noted joyful person, Ross Gay, has checked in.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I get it. And then so then I had to write this introduction where I sort of raise the question. I articulate that in a different way.
Actually, I was wondering, could you read from the book a little bit, actually that part? Because I found it to be a really interesting interrogation of this idea that I think you say something like, it's a sort of a dangerous fantasy, you write, to think that joy means without pain.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you kind of read the part of the book that sort of fleshes that idea out a little bit.
Right. But what happens if joy is not separate from pain? What if joy and pain are fundamentally tangled up with one another? Or even more to the point, what if joy is not only entangled with pain or suffering or sorrow, but is also what emerges from how we care for each other through those things? What if joy, instead of refuge or relief from heartbreak, is what efflorescences from us as we help each other carry our heartbreaks? Which is to say, what if joy needs sorrow? Or what Zadie Smith in her essay, Joy, calls the intolerable for its existence? If it sounds like I'm advocating for sorrow, nope. Besides, sorrow, unlike joy apparently, doesn't need an advocate. Given as, to quote the visionary blind man Pozzo in Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, we're born, quote, astride a grave, i.e., we and everyone and everything we love will one day, maybe today, die. I think sorrow's going to be just fine. Like Gwendolyn Brooks says about death, one of sorrow's chauffeurs, it's, quote, just down the street, is most obliging neighbor, can meet you at any moment, end quote. Or, as the Jackson 5 sing, not in the voice of sorrow, but kinda, I'll be there. But what I am advocating, and adamantly so, is that rather than quarantining ourselves or running from sorrow, rather than warring with sorrow, we lay down our swords and invite sorrow in. I'm suggesting we make sorrow some tea from the lemon balm in the garden. We let sorrow wash up and take some of our clothes. We give sorrow our dad's slippers that we've hung on to for 15 years for just this occasion. And we drape our murdered buddy's scarf, still smelling of Nag Champa, over sorrow's shoulders to warm them up some. We wedge some wood in the fire. As we're refilling their tea, we notice sorrow is drinking from a mug given to us by someone we've hurt.
That's Ross Gay reading from Inciting Joy. This is LiveWire from PRX. We are talking to writer and poet Ross Gay about his new book, Inciting Joy. When we get back, we're going to talk to Ross about something that he and I were both very obsessed with as kids, and that would be skateboarding. So stick around for that. Back with more LiveWire in just a moment. All right, welcome back to LiveWire. Coming to you this week from Town Hall. We're talking to Ross Gay about his incredible latest book, Inciting Joy. One of the things that you write about in this book is this question of privilege, because to say gardening, which is something that you love, incites joy for you, naturally raises the question, what about people who don't have access to a garden? Mm-hmm. Or what about people who don't have access to the things that can incite joy for us? And you talk about it in a really interesting way. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, I sort of, I've been thinking a lot about this. The term privilege is almost, it's sort of, I mean, there's many things. One thing is that just saying privilege almost feels, it seems like some people think to say that is an action, you know? And that ultimately what privilege, the sort of notion of privilege, like, oh, you're privileged because you have a place to garden, or you're privileged because you have, breathable air, or you're privileged because you can drink the water that comes out of your tap, or you're privileged because you're not getting beat up by a cop, or you're privileged because on and on and on and on, which obscures the fact that to have all of those things happen to you is evidence actually of disprivilege. You know, it's evidence of a brutality. And furthermore, it's evidence of a brutality that is action. So privilege is a way, to say privilege often is a way to actually obscure this thing. Privilege just sort of almost makes it natural. You know, oh, it's just privilege. That's just the way it is. I'm privileged. Bummer. When in fact, it's like, no, the reason there's lead in the water is because people let there be lead in the water.
Right. That's not a privilege.
No, it's not a privilege. Yeah. It's not a privilege not to be poisoned.
Right.
Right.
It's a disprivilege to be poisoned.
I believe you describe it as violence in the book. In other words, the people who are not having the privilege of a garden, it's in a way to not have access to, like, again, breathable air, drinkable water. That's the violence.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
That everyone should be able to have a garden and drink the water.
If you want to have a garden, you want to be able to get into a garden, you should be able to get into a garden. If you want to have, I say in the book, like a relationship with a tree, you want to be able to like smell flowers. You want to be able to harvest. You want to be able to, pitch in to do all of this sort of processes that affords one, the gifts that sort of, gives you, that just ought to be life. Mm-hmm. The absence of that or the withholding of that, because it's a withholding, is a brutality.
You write about two things in this book that were the complete kind of cornerstones of my life as a kid, which were pickup basketball and skateboarding, which is part of why I enjoyed this book so much. I was wondering if you could read a little bit from the chapter. It's Share Your Bucket. It's the fifth incitement, and it's about skateboarding. Could you read from that? Because you brought up something that I never really thought about, but it was totally my lived experience with me and my buddies and swapping stuff on our boards. And, you got those new OJs and the kind of communal nature of being into skateboarding.
Yes. Share Your Bucket. skateboarding, the fifth incitement. Perhaps somewhat telling is that when Stephanie and I were counseled by our couples therapist to spend some time imagining a safe place before entering a difficult conversation, I didn't choose a mountain stream or a forest or a glade or a meadow or a beach. I chose, along with a basketball court, a curb at the IGA at Pine Watson Shopping Center in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, where one weekend night after hours, my buddy Jay and I, when we were in our late teens, dragged one of the shopping carts to the curb, tipped it over, then pushing on our skateboards beneath the flickering lights beneath the plaza's overhang toward the cart at the end of the curb, in one sometimes seamless motion, we would get our feet right, bend just a touch, and ollie over the cart into the dark. Or tired of that, we rail slid the cart, or tried to ollie it long ways. Maybe we stood the cart up on its wheels and tried going over it that way. All of these attempts, I'm noticing this now, from some light into dark. Which is a nice metaphysical metaphor for our inquiry into joy. Skating on a John Lucero hand-me-down given to me by my friend Mike, with rat bones, which wheels Jay gave me earlier that day, inside of which are some very smooth bearings that Adam gave to him, ollieing into the mystery. The metaphysical metaphor being that submission to mystery is a possible source of joy. Noted. Also, of course, is that I am skating with a beloved pal, ollieing into the dark under the watchful gaze of someone doing the same. That seems relevant, too. We are studying each other, beholding each other, flying into the dark. It is to that feeling, which, if I were to locate it, is in my chest, and it is the feeling of groundlessness, that I go before a tough chat. Footnote. Worth noting, too, how often we fall skating. Though also worth noting, you see how I wrote it a few sentences ago, is that skateboarding, at least between the mid-80s and mid-90s, was one of the many places the gift economy was in radical action, by which I mean in practice. It was just the case that whatever you had extra, and skateboarding with its many components, decks, wheels, bearings, trucks, bushings, riser pads, rails, rip grip, bolts, etc., made for extra, you passed along. Most of us had a bucket of some sort where, when someone needed something, we dug around to find it. I never once heard anyone express it as an ethics, sharing, redistribution, commonwealthing. Though if you tried to keep your extra to yourself, if you spoke to no one of your bucket, and then it got out you had one, and gleaming like gold in that extra independent truck, independent's a brand name, a truck is the thing that holds the wheels on. Was the kingpin's the thing that holds the truck together. One of us needed to skate that day, the reaction would be an ethical one. Yo, that's f***ed up, man. Also worth noting is that skateboarding's reemergence, at least in the U.S., is almost perfectly concurrent with a new gilded age, a grotesque accumulation and celebration of wealth, deregulation, the dismantling of the welfare state, mass incarceration, NAFTA, taking the solar panels off the roof of the White House, privatization of everything, further enclosure of the commons, and the unabashed, unapologetic, mongering sanctification of hoarding, of the hoard. It is probably for this reason, the aforementioned ethics, I'm saying, that if you were ever inclined to go down a YouTube rabbit hole watching Mark Gonzalez, the Sun Ra of skateboarding, or possibly even the Dizzy Gillespie of skateboarding, the Andy Kaufman of skateboarding, you would find that in fully one-third of his abundant footage, from when he was a skinny California kid in the mid-80s all the way to his present-day full-figured middle-aged technical goofballery, he is encountering, negotiating with, cajoling, resisting, or running from the so-called law, owners or cops, bought and rented, usually because he is skating somewhere he should not be, which is most everywhere. Probably because there's a perfect rail or a sweet bit of transition to a gap or a set of stairs calling him. Dude's been at it for decades. He's made it. He's a grown-ass man. Why doesn't he just buy his own skate park? He should know better. But he never learns. One reason Gonz is among the trillion beating hearts of skateboarding, and in this he is in no way singular or the best. Gonz is just one of a trillion apostles of the form, is because he usufructs the skatable world, which includes benches, picnic tables, walls, handrails, flights of steps, curbs, fire hydrants, ledges, parking lots, sidewalks, driveways, loading docks, loading ramps, bus stops, parking garages, schoolyards, drainage ditches, streets, alleys, walls, i.e. the built environment, whether new or in disrepair. In other words, the only limitation to what might be skated or made public or commoned or shared is the imagination.
That's Ross Gay. Reading from Inciting Joy here on LiveWire. As a kid who grew up really, really wanting my parents to dedicate our entire backyard in Seattle to a half pipe, which never happened. It would have been the entirety of the backyard. I was so jealous of people who had either like a ramp or access to a skate park or whatever. But you write in this book that you're kind of glad that you didn't grow up where there were skate parks everywhere.
Yeah, and it's funny. So many things. It's funny to get to an age where I'm like, oh, man, I'm so glad we didn't have that then. Mm-hmm. You know, and among them, I talk about water. You know, I mean, we had water, but we didn't have bottled water. And right. It was amazing. And we, you know, we didn't have cell phones. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. We could get lost and be alone. It was incredible. Oh, my God. Children, you don't know what you're missing. But the other thing, yeah, like that sort of experience of like walking around the world, as I still do. I'm 48 years old, and like every once in a while I'll skateboard, I'll putter around. But I always walk around and I look at the city, the built environment, I'm like, ooh, you could skate that. You know, there's, oh, that's to be skated, you know, again and again. And which the way that I think of it, it is kind of like you're being trained to sort of witness or being trained to sort of observe how everything is something else, you know? So you're being trained in metaphor in a way, you know, which to me feels like a profound sort of actually survival skill. Wow. You know, oh, you could use this for that, you know?
That's Ross Gay here on LiveWire, everyone. The new book is Inciting Joy. Ross, thank you so much. That was Ross Gay right here on LiveWire, recorded at Town Hall in Seattle. His latest book, Inciting Joy, is available now. Hey, special thanks this week to Miriam Fearley, Portland, Oregon, and Michael Smith of Everett, Washington. Miriam and Michael are part of the LiveWire member community and are generously supporting the show with a donation each month. They're in the League of Extraordinary Listeners, y'all. And that support is really big because it's how we're able to keep doing LiveWire. So thanks to Miriam and Michael for keeping the show going. This is LiveWire, as we do each week. We ask the LiveWire listeners a question. We wanted to know what their perfect weekend might be like. Lena has been collecting up those answers. What are you seeing?
Well, I read these a little too quickly, and when I saw D's, I got really excited because, well, D actually wrote a Catan tournament, which I believe is some kind of board game.
Okay, like Settlers of Catan. I believe that's a board game that's very involved that people get really into.
Yeah, yeah. So that is what D would include in D's perfect weekend. But I misread it as a caftan tournament, which I would totally attend and win.
You know, I started earlier in the show talking about the pizza acrobatics championship. I would say caftan, Settlers of Caftan would be an only slightly more niche sport, and you would be the reigning world champion. I don't know anyone who owns more caftans than you.
I bought 3 caftans the week of my 40th birthday. Like, I was just trying to, like, manifest my Golden Girls future.
It's working. Absolutely.
Thank you.
What's another perfect weekend for one of our listeners?
Here's a blast from the past from Heather. Heather's perfect weekend, GTL, baby, gym, tan, and laundry.
Whoa.
Are you familiar with the GTL sect?
Oh, I very much am. You know, that would be a Jersey Shore reference, I believe, right? That was how they used to do.
I wonder if they ever opened, like, you know how they have like a Kentucky Hut, like a Pizza Hut, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell? Somebody should have made a place where you could do your laundry, get tan, and work out all in the same fused space.
I mean, there would be a convenience to that, certainly. Okay, one more before we move on.
I love Aaron's perfect weekend, which is watching a true crime documentary on Friday and then being too afraid to leave my house for the rest of the weekend.
Yes, I have definitely experienced that myself, a lost weekend of watching too much true crime. And then, you know, being a little afraid that I might be the next person being profiled in one of those things.
Anytime anyone says that I light up a room, I'm always terrified that I'm going to be on the next Forensic Files.
You need to really watch out.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you to everyone who sent in their response to our question this week. Our next guest's life started on a small farm in Indiana before she made her way to Chicago, where she ran her own Michelin-starred restaurant. These days, you can find her in the remote woods of Michigan, where she runs the Milkweed Inn, the most amazing weekend experience that you will never get a reservation for. It's booked out for like years. Her latest book is the really incredible Fieldwork, A Forager's Guide. Take a listen to this. It's our conversation with Elena Regan right here on LiveWire. Hi, Elena.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You write in this book that you had like an awakening in 1984, which would have made you like 5 years old?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Around there?
Ish, yeah.
1984, what happened? You went foraging with your family and something like clicked?
I think I was already doing that prior to 1984, but I think that was like when me as the writer here now could actually think about, well, when was it that I could remember like enough to, you know, kind of channel these stories and be able to talk about them and write about them. And so I focus on that year, 1984, because that's when I could really pull that information.
Thanks.
Sure.
By the way, backstage, you were like very proud. You're like, I have my reading glasses with
me. Yeah, but then I didn't bring the little
cleaner.
So wait, what
have it. Clean. Why don't you go ahead and get your readers ready?
I know you're gonna ask me to read some.
Yeah.
I'm trying to. I should have did this when I was just back there farting around.
This is.
I should have had this done. Like, that's the chef part of me talking, like, why the hell did you not have your readers ready?
Well, speaking of being a chef, you didn't go to culinary school, right? But you write in this book about you growing up in a family of people that could cook. Do you feel like cooking is hereditary, is something you can inherit?
Well, I don't know if it's hereditary or able to inherit, but I think that there is something to intuition. And if you grow up maybe in an environment where you're surrounded by people who are cooking or foraging in that sort of way, that maybe some of that could get implanted into you. And I'm currently learning about recipes that my family has that almost I feel like I learned through osmosis, through my mom, or somehow through like my DNA, like, or my ancestors, like I talk about in this book, whispering to me. And of course, like, sure, maybe that's just multiple personalities or something. I feel like there is some sort of channeling that's going on. So
I want to make sure that I have your kind of journey with food correct. So from the book, you, as a teenager, you were bussing tables at an Italian restaurant, and then you make your way into the kitchen, and you end up working at Alinea, which is like one of the greatest restaurants in the world in Chicago.
Yeah, and I mean, then, not anymore.
Right, you, well, okay, when you were there. Wow, shots fired. I don't think we're on in Chicago, so say whatever you want. And then you walked away from Alinea to make your own ranch dressing and sell it at a farmer's market. And then eventually start your own restaurant, which won a Michelin star every single year that you were running it. And then you more or less gave that restaurant to some of your employees.
Yeah.
And
I
then
mean,
went to
yes.
the woods of Michigan.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, that's the gist. Yeah. You got the ranch dressing. I mean.
That never happened?
Okay, so there is a part in my other book, Burn the Place, where at this Italian restaurant, if you take this bread that's like from Toronto and, you know, the Toronto bakeries, and you put it in the oven and then you dip it in like the Kraft dressing that probably came in a vat, and then you put like, I don't know, some sort of manufactured Parmesan cheese on it, I mean, it's fantastic. So it's like you can have an epiphany having ranch dressing, and I think that was a little bit in my last book.
I think I
made pierogies at the farmer's market, okay. Not the ranch.
Somewhere, we've got to get someone to take down an article where it talks about you making homemade ranch dressing, because...
I mean, I've made homemade ranch dressing.
I just loved that for your bio so much, I guess I wanted it to be true. Now, by the way, we're talking to Elena Regan about her book Fieldwork, A Forager's Memoir, here on LiveWire Radio. One of the things that you said in the book is that you really like cooking, but you don't like being a chef.
Well, I mean, okay, here's the thing. There's, essentially, I'm in the business of entertainment, right? In a way that as a chef and having a restaurant, I'm performing. And I don't want to get into all the moral dilemmas that I have with that, not only like environmentally, but also just physically, mentally, whatever. We don't have time for that. In this 15 minutes, what I can say is...
I appreciate you producing the show on the fly. Good looking out.
I think that as chefs, sometimes people are taking themselves too seriously, and they're causing a whole lot of other, like, young people who are interested in food and interested in creation, artistically or whatever, a lot of strife. I think that everything's getting taken too seriously, has been for a long time. It's not brain surgery, it's entertainment. So I love actually being a chef, and I love entertaining people, and I love cooking for others. But I think some of that pressure and some of those ideas around it, where chefs are storming through kitchens and they're mad at their employees, and they're, you know, like, this thing needs to be this way, is just so, it's like, what's the point? You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So now, if I understand it right, if you yell at an employee, it's your wife?
Yes. Absolutely. She pisses me off.
Because you and your wife now run the Milkweed Inn in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is a sort of phenomenon unto itself, because it's this incredibly beautiful location with what sounds like an amazing time for a very, very small number of people during the summer months. You pick them up at the truck stop?
The reason why I wanted to do that was to kind of go back to my roots, because when I started out, I was like, long story short, I don't want to do all this working through kitchens with all these tyrannical chefs. I'm going to do my own thing, sell pierogies at the farmer's market, not ranch dressing.
All right.
But
agree to disagree. I'm hearing different things.
I mean, the inspiration comes from somewhere. Now I'm going to make some ranch dressing.
Please do.
Pierogies someday. But... Anyways, so I have this little like underground thing at my house where I serve 10 people on Fridays and 10 people on Saturdays.
And this is when you're living in Chicago.
Right. And then it forms into a restaurant, which was my goal. And then eventually I'm like, I don't want a restaurant anymore. I don't want to have employees. I don't want to do this whole thing. But it was so much more sustainable just doing it small, being able to actually go out and forage myself or grow the things myself. I mean, it's a lot of hard work, and it's just as much of a headache in a different way than it is of doing books or payroll or all those things. But at least I know that at Milkweed, to get through one service, I'm not using like 500 gallons of water a day, or I don't have the electricity going on all day. And some of the natural resources that we use in just one day in this entertainment business is a lot in just one restaurant in one city that serves 25 people. I have these dilemmas, like when I was at the airport this morning, I was thinking like, what if just one airport in this country like just didn't have any meat anymore? You know, like just one, I'm sure it'd piss a lot of people off.
That wouldn't go over well at the Buffalo Wild Wings.
Right, but just like, you know what I mean? So like I'm sitting here getting at the airport, getting ready to come here, and I'm just like, well, why am I having these thoughts? But at the same time, it's good thoughts, and this is frustrating, and I'm like, I just need to go back to bed. But, you know,
yeah.
that's the whole thing. Anyways, you'll read in this book, if you do get my book, that there's a lot of things that keep me up at night, so you won't be surprised about that.
Actually, can we hear a little bit from the book Fieldwork? Because it is a forager's memoir, and you do talk a lot about all of these amazing things that you forage, particularly mushrooms. So could you read a little bit about that?
Yeah. This is from chapter 15 called Ephemeral Sexual Organ. it's not that sexy. All right. So we're going to kind of start in a couple paragraphs in. Mushrooms are sexy. Some are multigendered. Others are male and some are female. Some reproduce together and some are asexual, able to reproduce on their own. Mushrooms are more like animals than plants, but I don't know exactly how. I'm not a mycologist. I'm not a botanist or an anthropologist. I'm just a person who prefers mushrooms to people and trees to tall buildings. A person who spends many hours alone thinking too much about what I'm thinking. I do study some of what I write about. I have tried to understand how mushrooms reproduced, and the best explanation I've heard was told to me by my friend Rebecca, who is a mycologist. The fruiting body is the ephemeral sexual organ of the mushroom. The rest of the organism resides underground as mycelium, the part that we see just fruits to fulfill a reproductive function. She told me this, and I wondered if this was why mushrooms tasted so good. In any case, mushrooms are fascinating. People hunt them, dream about them, fall in love with them. Some people even have festivals to celebrate different seasons and species of them. And out of the many wildly beautiful organisms in the forest, mushrooms will more often than not stop you in your tracks for a closer look. On August 17, 1979, sometime in the late morning, I fruited. Okay, so I shouldn't have put my actual birth date in there, not because I'm afraid of how old you guys know that I am, because it's not that old. So I'm sorry, apologize to anybody older than me in the audience. But just don't go looking for my mom's maiden name and things like that, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so on August 1st, 1979, sometime in the late morning, I fruited. I was swaddled against Mom's chest by the time Dad got to the hospital. He was dusty from Grandpa's farm. He'd been out on the tractor in Grandpa's field, sculpting a new patch of land for next season's corn when he got the call that Mom was in labor. He had two sheep's head mushrooms bundled in paper napkins. He stood in the hospital room's doorway, the mushrooms swaddled against his chest. He stepped into the room, and with his free arm, he reached out for me. Mom turned, shielding me from his reach. She told him to wash himself off first. He set down the mushrooms on the tray table at her bedside. After he washed up, he held me for a couple of minutes. Passing me back to Mom, he said, "Found two sheep's head." And nodded to where he had set them. "Come real early this year. Been some good rain, though," he said, scratching his cheek. "I never found him this early before." Mom didn't respond right away. She was exhausted, but awake enough to tell him to move the mushrooms from her tray table. The sun rose over the window. A distant church bell confirmed it was noon. The window was open, and a fan churned where it was propped against the screen. A couple of bees, pulled by the fan, bumped against the screen. The air of the room 3E was warm and thick and smelled of fresh baby and starched hospital sheets. Dad sat in a chair beside the bed. In Mom's arm, I was 7 pounds and a few ounces against her breast. My sisters would arrive soon, but were late as well. Dad asked what was taking them so long. Mom didn't answer, figuring whatever it was, they were up to no good. Dad pressed the shiny pads of his calloused palms together and hung his hands down between his knees like he was praying to the floor.
Elena Regan, reading from her book Fieldwork, here on Livewire. That was Elena Regan, recorded in front of a live audience at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland, Oregon. Elena's book, Fieldwork, A Forager's Guide, is available now. Also, if you would like to hear more from that conversation, please check out the Livewire podcast where we, as you remember, Elena, our Elena, we had other Elena play a round of Metal or Mushroom. Where she had to decide
if we
were describing a famous metal band name or an actual mushroom species.
Harder than you think.
Yeah, it thrashed most hard. So check out the Livewire podcast for that. This is Livewire Radio from PRX. We've got to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, we are going to hear some delightful music from singer-songwriter Baroque Betty, accompanied by Mood Area 52. Sounds mysterious. Stick around to find out what we're talking about here on Livewire. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. This is LiveWire. Before we get to our musical guest, a little preview of next week's show. We are going to be talking to the very popular, very funny, very touring comic Gary Gulman. I have been a fan of Gary Gulman's for like decades now. He's got 4 comedy specials under his belt, including one that was on HBO called The Great Depression, which dealt with his real life mental health stuff and also was, as all of his stuff is, super duper funny. He's been on every late night show you can imagine. And he's got a new book out. It's called Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s, about his misadventures growing up. Plus, we're going to have Oregon poet laureate and longtime friend of the show, Anis Mojgani, stopping by. He's going to perform some works from his 6th collection of poetry. It's called The Tigers, They Let Me. And we'll also have some music from singer-songwriter Olive Klug. Sometimes checking your email, let's be honest, can be a little stressful. But we want to change that over here at Livewire. We want to make checking your email more joyful with our weekly newsletter, which is only good news. That's all we do over here at the Livewire newsletter. We got sneak peeks and deep dives on upcoming events, details on where you can join us live, new episode drops, and even more than that. Getting this drop of joy, it's super easy too. You head over to livewireradio.org and you click Keep in Touch. It takes like 30 seconds, 25 if you're speedy. So help us help you have a little more fun in your inbox with the latest from the Livewire newsletter. This is Livewire from PRX. Our musical guest this week hails from Eugene, Oregon, and has built a dedicated following of both fans and musicians, including Woody Platt from the Steep Canyon Rangers, who describes her sound as striking and spectacular. Take a listen to this. It's Baroque Betty, accompanied by Mood Area 52, recorded live at the Holt Center in Eugene, Oregon. What song are we going to hear?
This is the title track to my album. It's called Sobering Up. Broken too, just praying I'll get there, just to hold the last thread of us wrapped around my little finger. I've always been good at hanging on in a catastrophe. You've always been good at professing your apathy on this carousel, rusted and sputtering out. hotel room with the housekeeping knocking just to borrow some time that hadn't already been stolen. I've always been good at pretending you love me. You've always been good at making me crazy enough to think that you've always been walking the
That was Baroque Betty, accompanied by Mood Area 52, right here on Livewire. Her album, Sobering Up, is available now. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the show. A huge thanks to our guests, Ross Gay, Elena Regan, and Baroque Betty, along with Mood Area 52.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer, Heather D. Michelle is our executive director, and our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. Molly Pettit is our technical director, and our house sound is by D. Neil Blake. Trey Hester is our assistant editor and mixer. Our marketing and production manager is Karen Pan. Rosa Garcia is our operations associate. Jackie Ibarra is our production fellow, and Julian McElmurray is our intern. Our house band is Ethan Fox Tucker, Sam Tucker, A.L. Alves, and A. Walker Spring, who also composes our music.
Additional funding provided by the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. Livewire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank members Miriam Fierley of Portland, Oregon, and Michael Smith of Everett, Washington. For more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank for Elena Passarello and the whole Livewire crew. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of Livewire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the Livewire podcast feed, and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app, and bam, you are Livewire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about Livewire. And thank you.